From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The United States didn't see September 11th coming. In his book, Ivory Towers on Sand, Martin Kramer holds Middle East scholars in America squarely responsible for failing to read the warning signs. They sugarcoated the most extreme forms of Islamic fundamentalism, calling them democracy movements in disguise, he says. They studied moderate Islamic reformers, but not Osama bin Laden. This hour, a call for Middle East scholars to step out of their ivory tower and into the global political fray. And this hour with news of what has not happened. Last night, the FBI issued an urgent alert warning of a possible attack against Americans as early as today. Bob Drogon covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. Earlier, I asked him what he makes of this alert and who's behind it.
The alert came about because a detainee in Guantanamo Bay, a Yemeni man who was picked up in Afghanistan, apparently said during his interrogation that someone he knew had a brother in Afghanistan who had warned of an attack on or about February 12th. It was very unclear to the U.S. authorities whether this attack would be in the United States or in Yemen, where the alleged suspects were from. But that's what really prompted the alert. The FBI felt that given the specificity of the date, if not a target, that it was only prudent to alert law enforcement authorities of a possible attack.
And yet you've got a nation of 270 million people responding to a guy in Guantanamo who said that someone in Afghanistan's brother mentioned a date. Is that enough these days to get the whole security system into high gear?
Well, apparently it is. I mean, no one wants to be on the wrong side of a investigation if, God forbid, there is some kind of attack. And we all go back afterwards and say, you know, what did you know and when did you know it? And it's turned out that there was a warning in the system. I think the prevailing view in the administration and certainly in the FBI at this point is better safe than sorry.
And the functional intent of these warnings is to put law enforcement authorities on high alert or to put civilians on high alert? What exactly does the government intend their warnings to produce?
This particular warning was unusual because, as you know, we've had several over the last several months. This was the first that had a specific date attached to it, that had a individual's name as well as more than a dozen others. The FBI put their pictures on their website. So it was a much more specific warning involving individuals. It was, however, a little less clear since no target was identified, as in some of the previous warnings. It kind of leaves everyone, I think, out there scratching their heads.
But what does it mean in concrete terms? Do police go on overtime? Is the National Guard called up, or is it just a call for alertness?
This one appears to be a call for alertness by asking the 18,000 law enforcement agencies around the country. It's basically given them some names and faces to look for. It tells people, the American people, if you see this guy or anything, you know, who looks like him or sounds like him, please notify the police. That said, there's no evidence that at least the FBI had as of earlier today that any of these people are in the United States. There have been some unconfirmed reports that one of them may have turned up earlier today out on the West Coast. That remains unconfirmed at this point.
And there's a particular suspect tied or linked to this warning, a Yemeni national born in Saudi Arabia, Fawaz Yahya al-Rabieh. How did a particular name come to be attached to this warning?
What we do know is that we don't know very much about him. He was not on any of the previous FBI watch lists that have been distributed to the law enforcement authorities. His name really hasn't come up in public as part of any of the investigations into al-Qaeda. And in fact, one of the unusual things about this particular warning is it doesn't allege that these men are members of al-Qaeda. It's kind of unclear what the plot entails or whether it's a real plot. I mean, there's obviously, as we've seen in Afghanistan, an enormous amount of misinformation and disinformation that's going around.
There are also breaking developments, Bob Drogon, today in London regarding a suspect thought to have trained the September 11th hijackers. What happened today with his case?
His name is Lotfi Laisi, and he was arrested on September 21 last year. And at the time, his case drew international headlines because the FBI said he was the lead trainer of the hijackers. What happened today was the judge had ordered the U.S. government to provide evidence as to why they should continue to hold him in custody, and he apparently was unconvinced, and the judge released him on $15,000 bond, pending a further extradition hearing on relatively minor charges in Arizona. But, you know, it's a blow to the United States that a guy who at least publicly they were claiming some months ago was a key suspect is now able to walk free in London.
And a British judge is saying there's not sufficient evidence to hold him.
And the fact is they didn't put anything forward today in this case. It seems to me more emblematic of the fact that just as in the United States, where, as you recall, 1,200 or so people were rounded up after September 11th, none of those cases really resulted in a specific terrorism charge. Most of those people have now been released, and only one was ever charged with terrorism related to September 11th. That was Zacharias Moussaoui, and he'd been picked up before September 11th. Overseas, there have been hundreds of cases, and the case of Mr. Raisi in London was arguably the most prominent of those picked up and specifically linked or supposedly linked to September 11th, and now that case appears to be crumbling.
Bob Drogon, does that indicate to you that the U.S. investigation overall is not coming together, that they're not able to draw together the strings that would have kept even this very prominent detainee in jail?
It suggests that the investigations overseas are a very mixed bag and that they've run into a lot of difficulties. The head of the CIA testified last week that there have been about 1,000 people arrested in more than 60 countries. He called them al-Qaeda operatives. I understand it's something less than that, and certainly not all of them remain in custody. So it seems very much a mixed bag of who's picking up whom and on what charges. But this case is notable just because he was such a high-profile figure back last fall.
Have most of the detainees in the United States been released now, and are others overseas likely to be going free soon if a more hard evidence isn't brought to the fore?
In the United States, the last figures I saw, I believe there were about 75 people have been charged with various criminal offenses, none of them specifically related to September 11, and several hundred others remain in immigration custody for various immigration violations. But more than half the people have been released and sent home. Overseas, it's very hard to know. As I said, the CIA director said there have been about 1,000 arrests. My understanding is a good many of them have been released over the last couple of months, but it's been very hard to figure out exactly how many.
Bob Drogon covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Bethesda, Maryland. After September 11th, America turned to its Middle East scholars to explain the history and the rationale behind the terrorist attacks. Hindsight may be 20/20, but should academics have foreseen the lethal significance of growing antagonism in the Islamic world toward the West? Yes, Martin Kramer says, but it's no surprise that they didn't. In his new book, Ivory Towers on Sand, Kramer presents a scathing critique of Middle Eastern studies in America. Quote, "It is no exaggeration to say that America's academics have failed to predict or explain the major evolutions of Middle Eastern politics and society over the past two decades." What gap do American intellectuals need to fill in the Middle East conversation? Do you believe they've had the story wrong? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Martin Kramer. He's author of Ivory Towers on Sand, The Failure of Middle Eastern Studies in America, and editor of the Middle East Quarterly. He's a visiting professor at Brandeis University. Good evening and welcome, Martin Kramer.
Good evening.
Also joining us tonight is On Point guest analyst Anthony Lewis, former columnist with the New York Times. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Lewis.
Hello.
Martin Kramer, give us the core of your critique of American scholarship on the Middle East. What is wrong in your view?
What is wrong is that scholarship is driven largely by a vision of what the Middle East should be and not what the Middle East is. It's a Middle East which we all would hope would be characterized by Islamic movements which have moderated and which are willing to enter into politics on the basis of pluralistic tolerance. It's a Middle East where we would like to see the authoritarian regimes set aside their ways and move towards democracy. This is what we'd like to see. This is what Middle Eastern scholars have thought they saw, but it's not there.
You've been a visiting professor at the University of Chicago. You've been at Cornell, Georgetown, now Brandeis. What's going on in your mind? Why do you believe that American scholars are getting the picture wrong?
Well, there are many complex reasons. I would say that looking back over the past decade, the main desire of Middle Eastern scholars was to place the Middle East in some kind of universal context. things were changing elsewhere in the world. Mm-hmm. In Eastern Europe, democracy blossomed. The Soviet Union had fallen. There was change in Latin America. And many scholars in different political science departments across the land were going off to advise governments on transitions to market economics and to democracy. The Middle Eastern scholars were left at home in the course of the 90s. And I think what they did was to try to imagine that these same processes were underway, and when they couldn't see the forces that would have moved the Middle East in that direction, they imagined them. And Islamic movements included as democracy movements, as movements which would carry the region to a reform that would be broad-based and and that would equalize the situation in the Middle East with that of the rest of the world.
So you're saying in looking for the silver lining, they missed the threat. They missed the Osama bin Laden camp.
Oh, I think so. In the case of in the study of Islamic thought, there's no question that the great focus of Middle Eastern studies in the 1990s was looking for a great reformer of Islam, someone who would effect an Islamic reformation. And large tomes were produced on the thought of a whole host of reformers. I'm sure you wouldn't recognize any of the names. Osama bin Laden was not considered a legitimate subject for research. He represented the Islam that no one in academia was prepared to identify with. They even regarded him as being, in a way, outside Islam and hence outside the boundaries of legitimate research. It was left to terrorism experts, mostly outside academia.
So you say this came about, in your view, partly because these scholars saw the great changes going on elsewhere in the world and felt a natural urge to look for comparable changes in the Islamic world. But is that enough to explain? You're really describing what you see as wishful thinking on the part of academics. Academics are supposed to be trained in rigorous collection of data and in rigorous observation. It must have been more than the you know, party around the Berlin Wall that produced this wishful thinking, if indeed that's what it is. What's really going on there?
Well, the deeper roots have to do with ideology, I would say. Since 1981, it's been the argument of the New Guild of Middle Eastern Studies that the Middle East is not an exception. That to posit the Middle East as an exception to the rule is really a form of racism. It's pejorative and it's derogatory. And so if this is so, then, and it's Orientalist, I should add, that is, it's a successor to a whole series of prejudicial views about the Middle East which have been held from the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And so the whole project of Middle Eastern studies has been to show how the Middle East is like every other place. And it's been turned really into an ideological quest by scholars. What we've seen, of course, is that in many ways the Middle East remains an exception. It's probably more an exception today than it was 20 years ago when this wave started. And no one has accounted for that yet in the field.
Anthony Lewis, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the Israeli conflict and the Middle East in general. Do you agree with Martin Kramer that the U.S. scholars have got it so very wrong?
I don't want to agree or disagree.
All right. Tom.
I'd like first, in this first phase of our program, to ask Professor Kramer a question. Isn't there an element here, I'm just leaving aside the American Middle East studies people for a moment, of people in Middle Eastern countries where the political system is political systems are not open, and they're closed, they're tyrannical, and they're failed, and they're economically failed. Isn't there a tendency for people to turn, some of them, to turn to Islamic parties and Islamic movements as just a way of getting out from under the official party, the official state which so suppresses them? Isn't that an element in this process?
Martin Kramer, you can give us your 10-second answer. We'll come back for the rest.
It's one of many reasons people turn to Islamic movements. The question is what the leadership of Islamic movements does with the following they then amassed. And I think that the Osama bin Laden is a worrisome example in that respect.
Let's hold it right there. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking tonight with Martin Kramer. He's author of Ivory Towers on Sand, The Failure of Middle Eastern Studies in America. He says American scholars of the Middle East have got it all wrong. They've seen the region through rose-colored glasses, and we paid the price on September 11th. What do you think? Has America been well advised by the scholars who know the Middle East best? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
WRNIPR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Martin Kramer, and we're talking about the state of Middle East studies in American academia. It may seem rarefied, but Martin Kramer makes the case that it is integral to understanding what happened in and to the United States on September 11th. If you don't understand a whole region of the world, you're not going to know when the missiles, when the passenger jets hijacked, are coming. What do you think? Is the American view of the Middle East dangerously naive or so harsh that it creates enemies? Are you confident that America's leading thinkers on the Middle East are telling it like it is? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Martin Kramer, visiting professor at Brandeis University, and by our guest analyst this evening, Anthony Lewis. Tony Lewis, just before the break, you were putting the case, and Martin Kramer didn't really have time to respond fully, but that, I guess you're saying, haven't failed tyrannical political systems driven Middle Eastern populations to radical Islam?
Or to Islamic parties and movements. I don't know how radical.
All right.
That's what Professor Kramer was just beginning to answer.
Right. These movements are no doubt born aloft on a wave of resentments and frustrations. But that doesn't make them democracy movements. They are populist movements. But we've seen different populist movements throughout history surging through, for example, Europe earlier in this century, which did have a broad base, but which were not oriented towards instituting democratic norms. And I think that's pretty much the characteristic of most of these Islamic movements, with, I'd say, very few exceptions. The vision they offer is one of justice, not of democracy. Those are two different things. And I think that we have yet to see a movement emerge which carries aloft the flag of Islam, which was prepared to tolerate the kind of political pluralism which we're accustomed in the West.
We've had on this show some weeks ago Daniel Pipes, who I think was founder of the Middle East Quarterly, where you're now editor. And he made the case strongly. He said, George Bush is wrong to describe this as a war against evil. He said he should name and frame what that evil is. And he said the evil is Islamic, militant Islamic fundamentalism. That is strong medicine. That's a strong view. George Bush has, by and large, resisted that. Are you making the same argument here? And if so, is there a risk that by framing things in that way, we actually make enemies out of potential friends?
Well, it's let's say it would be a good operative conclusion to assume that those movements which have the United States highest on its target list are going to be Islamic movements. I don't know whether I agree that it makes a diplomatic sense to put that on the table, as long as it's understood in circles where it really counts. My feeling is that in circles where it really counts, that is understood, and that it does provide the agenda for the next stages in phase two and phase three, or if there are additional stages. I happen to think there's a wider range of threats to the United States in the Middle East than Islamic movements. And so from my point of view, I don't know that I would necessarily limit my definition of the threat to Islamic movements. I would include radical Islam in that, but I think that there are other threats as well, which could be at some point just as worrisome.
Martin Kramer, I don't want this to sound wrong, but it sort of, with this large population of Middle East scholars, the question that begs itself is, you know, who are you to stand up and say they've all got it wrong, that they're all lost their glasses at the supermarket and I've got the clear view?
Well, what I did in my book was really to take a couple of issues on which I thought the failing was manifest and undeniable. There are other contentious areas. Anthony Lewis has worked a lot about Arab-Israeli issues. I did not deal with the Arab-Israeli debate in my book because I thought that here there really is still room for difference of interpretation. But I thought that by the time we came to the year 1999-2000, the failure of Middle Eastern studies, both in, as you put it, sugarcoating Islamism and in manufacturing the idea that civil society was going to overwhelm authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, I thought that failure was manifest. And so I focused on those two. Who am I to do it? I'm part of the Guild, actually.
The Guild meaning the circle of those who make this their life study.
That's right. That's right. And I know it from the inside. No one else really in the Guild probably would take it on themselves. I've been overseas the past few years teaching abroad. I've been watching from a kind of distance. I call myself an intimate stranger to Middle Eastern studies, a product of it, but not dependent on it. And so I allowed myself.
And what do you think the consequences of this wishful thinking that you allege have been and are for the United States today?
First, let me correct you. I don't think that it would have been the job of Middle Eastern Studies to predict September 11th.
Duly noted.
I would say that if Middle Eastern Studies had been doing their job, they would have raised a red flag over the trends within Islamism that made September 11th possible. They did not decipher the handwriting on the wall. They did not see that there was handwriting on the wall. I think they didn't even see that there was a wall. And the whole trajectory of their interpretation went elsewhere. Let me give you just as a comparison with the Rabin assassination. Now, when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995, there was an array of Israeli scholars at universities who could say that in the previous 4 or 5 years, they had detected the possibility that among radical Jewish fundamentalists, there would be a willingness to kill other Jews. And so when it happened, people in academe in Israel were shocked but not surprised. September 11th, the situation here was completely different. People were shocked and surprised in academe because the entire trajectory of Islamism was predicted to be moving in a different direction, away from confrontation, towards accommodation, marginalization of violence. And that didn't happen.
Martin Kramer, Tony Lewis, would you like to come in?
I just was struck by something. Professor Kramer, you said you had deliberately avoided the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the book. And yet I've noticed that in this country, you have written in and been supported by journals that are very strongly identified with Israel we could say the conservative or right-wing side in Israel, the Weekly Standard, the Wall Street Journal, and other such magazines. And they seem to be sort of moving you into that conflict and saying, maybe they're saying that the Middle Eastern scholars that you criticize are insufficiently pro-Israel. Is there something to that? Maybe I just don't understand it.
You know, when you write a book, you assume it'll be read in a certain climate and by certain readers. I wrote this book before September 11th. Hmm. I assumed it would be read mostly by people in the field, not by people outside the field.
And yet, here you are tonight.
And here I am tonight. The book has different readers, and it gets different readings. I found that lots of people have taken an interest in the book who I never imagined would. There are people who are, for instance, education conservatives, who believe that this is a proper wedge to influence the course of academe generally. They're the people that you mentioned. I've even found that it's been quoted and cited by people on who have strong religious convictions and a grudge to bear against academe. I didn't really write the book for those people.
But that begs Tony Lewis's question, doesn't it? Do these affiliations indicate that you have a particular stance on Israel that informs your larger view?
Well, perhaps my larger view informs my stance on Israel. I mean, it's...
speak to it either way, please.
Look, I have an aversion to the tendency to focus in on someone's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict and judge everything they say subsequently on that basis. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the real weak spots of Middle Eastern studies generally, the pigeonholing. Mm-hmm. People get put in boxes. My inclination is to look at a text, look at an argument, and judge it by its merits. If something is published by the Institute for Palestine Studies, I don't immediately dismiss it. I read it and look for the validity of the argument. And there are things sometimes which I read which are written by people who write in that journal with which I agree in whole or in part. So I expect the same courtesy from others.
Martin Kramer, Anthony Lewis, stand by. We're joined now by Joel Bainan. He's president of the Middle East Studies Association, professor of Middle East History at Stanford University. Welcome and good evening, Professor Bainan.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us. I think you've heard a bit of our conversation here, and you surely are aware of Martin Kramer's thesis that the American Middle East Studies community has missed the boat, that it's been trapped by political bias and wishful thinking and seeing democratic reform where there was no such thing going on, and boom, we have 9/11. Doesn't draw the line directly, but it's not hard to feel that running through the book. What's your view of this critique, Professor Joel Bainan?
Fundamentally, I would say that Professor Kramer may or may not be right in his characterization of certain individuals, but I think he's incorrect in attributing these views to the Middle East studies community as a whole. There certainly were, for example, many, many people, including people who he criticizes prominently in his book, who have been warning that there is great anger, unhappiness, even disgust with the foreign policy of the United States mm-hmm. among Arabs, Muslims, and so on. I can recall a lecture, for example, by Rashid Khalidi, one of my predecessors as president of the Middle East Studies Association, and someone who comes in for some fairly sharp criticism in Professor Kramer's book as having said as much. Mm-hmm. In the summer before September 11th, Shibli Tilhami, who's a political scientist at the University of Maryland, published an op-ed in the New York Times summarizing some public opinion research he had done in Egypt, Lebanon, United Arab Emirates, and two other Middle Eastern countries in which the strong drift of anti-American sentiment was quite evident. So it's simply not the case that people in Middle East studies, all of them, didn't understand that this was happening.
So at some level, you would flat out deny that the awareness was not made clear by this community. Is there any sense in which you would agree with Martin Kramer that the American academic community around Middle East studies let the country down in conveying a full and accurate picture of what was going on in the Middle East pre-9/11?
Let the country down? No, I don't think so. I might agree that, for example, John Esposito's approach to understanding contemporary Islam has some flaws in it. I would certainly agree that the notion that civil society was about to happen in the Middle East in any kind of Western liberal sense was flawed. But these views were not the views unanimously held by people in the Middle East Studies Association. What scholarship is about, after all, is an open debate, and some of the views that Professor Kramer says were held by people in one form or another were held, but there were others on opposite sides. And more fundamentally, the reasons that Professor Kramer adduces for people having had these views are utterly and totally wrong.
Professor Bainan, Joel Bainan, do you see any danger here that in taking the tougher attitude toward Islamic militant Islam that Martin Kramer does, that the United States, through the agency of its scholars, could actually drive Islamic populations further into the fundamentalist radical camp and create enemies where there need be none?
I wouldn't put it exactly that way. What I would want to emphasize, and perhaps this is one of the things which Professor Kramer objects to, is there is a great diversity of opinion among the various Islamic movements. They are not all the same thing, and they are certainly not all Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
One needs to delve very particularly into the histories of particular places and to examine carefully the social bases of various movements and their various ideas to get some sense of what they're about. Now, doing that doesn't necessarily mean that they are, in fact, going to be about Western-style liberal mm-hmm. democracy. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they won't be. But I think it's fair to say and important to understand that neither are they all about Osama bin Laden.
Martin Kramer, a courteous Joel Bainan, responds that you have picked and chosen from the writings and works of American academics and I guess misrepresented this group in saying that it had an overall bent toward wishful thinking or too much optimism about democratic reform flourishing in the Middle East.
Well, I think that Professor Bainan perhaps is right to point to one or two voices that expressed other views. My impression is that the field is a good deal less diverse than he indicated. There are, of course, no views which are unanimously held in Middle Eastern studies. There are in the Middle East Studies Association 2,600 persons. That's why in my book I focused on people who tended to be leaders in the field, people who often were elected president of the Middle East Studies Association, including a name mentioned here, John Esposito. I don't want to mention other names in the course of the evening. My complaint is that the field is not sufficiently diverse. that we don't hear enough voices, that there isn't enough debate. It is a small field. You know, the Modern Language Association has 40,000 members. This is 2,600. In a small field, there's always a propensity and a danger of a guild-like evolution, which makes it difficult for people to express differing views. And my impression over the past 20 years is that it's gotten more and more difficult to do that. Civil society, by the way, was not something engaged in by a small number of scholars or interested enthusiasts.
The notion that it might be developing in the Middle East.
Right. This was the major project. There was lots of outside funding for it, by the way, to do it. And anyone who was anything in this field had their finger in this particular pie.
Martin Kramer, Joel Bannon, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in. Saeed is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Saeed. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening to both professor of university. I'm originally from Iran.
All right.
And I've been in this country 22 years. Mm-hmm. The University of Michigan, when I came to 1978 to study on my graduate work, has a huge inventory of the books written about the Islamic scholar. I do have some comment regarding of Professor Kramer's comment about the Islam.
So what's your view in a nutshell, Saeed?
My view of nutshell is for past 20 years, people are concentrating on this Islamic fundamentalism movement, which is a copycat of the Christian fundamentalism in the United States.
And has that been well?
Allow me finish, please.
I'm sorry.
Rise of people like Pat Robinson, Jerry Falwell in this country created the same situation in the Middle East because American government decided, hey, if the fundamentalism is going to win in this country, let's apply it to other countries.
So I want to be sure I understand, Saeed. Are you saying that American scholars were too focused on Islamic fundamentalism or not, not focused
on... about the fact that for past 2,000 years, there is wars. When Ottoman Empire fighting with Persian Empire during Islamic era, we had what we call the Persian Empire used to have, which I'm from that area of the world, Shia sect, and Ottoman Empire was Sunni.
Sure.
And these two religious were going to fight. That is, an Ottoman Empire never moved toward east because of the Persian Empire. So scholars in this country, they keep forgetting. And unfortunately, the scholars are coming from my country or Middle Eastern countries.
But what is it that they're forgetting, Saeed?
What they're forgetting is the fact that the Islamic fundamentalism doesn't exist in the Middle East. It's just the names. There are minorities groups. The populace does not support these people. If you go to the main population, even the uneducated, the people that we make a big deal out of them in Pakistan and say they go to Madaras. Madaras is the name for high school. If you translate Madaras, which is an Arabic word, if these two scholars they know, is a high school. You teach the books. The books that you're teaching in Madaras is the Quran, because Quran encouraged liberty. Every time Muhammad took over any type of nation, create the most democratic society. The Middle Eastern scholars for past 25 years, they're trying to portray in this country the Islam as a rigid religious.
Saeed, we've got to go, but I think you've got your point. You're saying Islamic fundamentalism maybe isn't so bad, I guess. We're talking about the Middle Eastern Studies group as a whole and their view of the Middle East. Has the U.S. been well served? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American view of the Middle East as shaped, as framed by the scholars on Middle Eastern studies in the United States. Our guest, Martin Kramer, says they've had a kind of love affair with a dream of a democratizing Middle East that just isn't so. And he suggests that that view took the entire nation, has taken the nation, into peril. What do you think? Has America been well advised by the scholars who know the Middle East best? Joel Bannon, I know we don't have you forever. I want to give you a last word here on this debate. What's really going on here? What's really at the heart of this debate, Professor Bannon?
Well, at the risk of being a little bit tendentious, I think what's at the heart of the debate, despite Professor Kramer's demur, is the Arab-Israeli conflict.
How so?
What happened in the Middle East Studies Association and among Middle East scholars more broadly was that modernization theory and economic development theory, which came from outside Middle East studies, unlike what Professor Kramer claims in his book, were brought into the field. And they basically argued that the Middle East is going to develop
along the trajectory of Western Europe and North America.
Mm-hmm.
And the civil war in Lebanon in 1975, the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power, and the protracted Arab-Israeli conflict showed that that was not the case. Now, those theories were promoted by people who are intellectually and politically, in some cases, the polar opposite of the people that Professor Kramer is mainly criticizing. And so when those people were younger, they began to search for new interpretations of things. And many of them drifted to various social history interpretations at first, and not at all to the views of Edward Said, who Professor Kramer in his book.
But take us to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Take us to the Arab-Israeli conflict connection. We're the great and washed, and we're waiting to hear how that figures in.
Well, the way it figures in is that among the critiques that were developed in this period of the late 70s and early 80s was a rather more critical approach to the Arab-Israeli conflict and to the American alliance with Israel and to Israel's treatment of the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And that went along with, I mean, it didn't necessarily go along with and not to the same extent for everyone, but it accompanied a generally more critical approach to older ways of understanding the region, ways in which Professor Kramer was trained and still maintained.
Are you suggesting that Martin Kramer's view of the world depends on seeing the Arab world to some extent as not capable of development or as intrinsically dangerous?
Wasn't that essentially what he argued before I came on, that the Middle East is the great exception to the rest of the world? The rest of the world is having democratization. We're seeing the economic growth that's not happening in the Middle East. So there is a certain insistence. Now, I wouldn't dispute, of course, the actual facts of the matter. Certainly, most of the governments in the Middle East are quite authoritarian. The level of economic development is rather pathetic and so on. The issue is, why are these things happening? Are they happening because there is something intrinsically wrong, defective about Islam, Arabs, so on? Mm. Or are there more social history type explanations for these things?
We're circling around some pretty important stuff here. Joel Bainan, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. Professor Joel Bainan is president of the Middle East Studies Association and professor of Middle East History at Stanford University. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
You're very welcome.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's open up the lines. Bill Beeman is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. That's a name I know. Good evening, Bill Beeman.
Hi, good evening. I'm glad to have a chance to chat with you. As you may realize, Martin Kramer's book on attacking the Middle East studies community,
yes,
and the Wall Street Journal editorial that really derived from that book caused a great deal of controversy within the association itself.
And Bill Beeman, we should identify you as in the field at Brown University.
That's correct. I'm a Middle East specialist at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Joel Bainan is absolutely correct. I've been, for one, warning since the 1980s about the rise of terrorism in the Middle East and linking it specifically to American policy. I had two or three editorials in the New York Times which specifically said this.
So you don't agree that the American academic community somehow let down the home team?
Well, I don't know. I've been advising the State Department. I've been writing for the New York Times. I've written for The Nation, for other publications. I've been speaking quite widely, not just myself, but also many of my colleagues, on precisely this, what Professor Kramer does not want to hear, and what Dan Pipes, who is allied with him, also does not want to hear, is that the United States itself bears a responsibility for the rise of this terrorism. This terrorist movement.
Are you looking back to the support from Mujahideen in Afghanistan or something else?
Well, that's one aspect of it. Of course, we did support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. In fact, created the conditions which led to the establishment of the Al Qaeda movement, and we also supported the Taliban, for heaven's sakes, before they actually became our enemies. And the this is one aspect of it. The other aspect is the situation which led to the establishment of a military presence in Saudi Arabia, something that that all Middle Eastern scholars warned against, and that the British declined to do for decades and decades and decades because they knew how dangerous it was.
Mm. Bill Beaman, we're grateful to you for coming on. Our time is running down, but thank you very much for bringing your two cents into the conversation. Martin Kramer, Joel Bainan says, hey, it wasn't as bad as you suggest. People did describe a range of situations and suggests that behind your critique somehow is, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Bill Beaman as much as says the same thing. How do you reply?
Well, the problem with the argument is this, that these very same people in Middle Eastern studies have been complaining about U.S. policy in the Middle East since time immemorial for 20 years. So there really was no change, nothing that would suddenly run up a red flag. So I find it curious when people come and say, well, of course, it's been U.S. policy. This has been the case for a long time. And the fact is that the very same people who were critical of U.S. policy were often apologetic on behalf of Islamic movements. Mm-hmm. So there's no contradiction between the two. The same people who said U.S. policy was a problem were the same people who were saying that Islamic movements were moving towards reconciliation and accommodation. There was a contradiction there.
Mm. Anthony Lewis, what do you hear in this debate, in this conversation among the scholars of our nation around the Middle East?
Well, some of it is recherche to me, and there are wheels and wheels here. But, I mean, I do think we're still circling around the Arab-Israeli dispute, the Palestinian-Israeli dispute.
Boil that down for us. How do you see
it
reflected?
I simply know that in many Islamic countries, television every night shows scenes of a Palestinian child being shot by Israeli soldiers, of houses being bulldozed down, Palestinian homes, and the women crying over their lost possessions and lost homes. And the power of that as an element in Middle East feelings simply cannot be overlooked. And as we almost just heard but didn't quite hear it, the United States' unflinching support, not just for Israel as such, which is entirely appropriate, but for the policies of the Sharon government, which have bottled up people in their villages for more than a year, which have assassinated a great many people, and so on. Of course, people may react against that and think the United States is not their friend. Isn't that true? I just seems logical to me.
Martin Kramer, we've just got 40 seconds left, but you hear Anthony Lewis's view.
The problem with that view, and I describe it as one of homing pigeons. You know, you can release people's minds everywhere from the Hindu Kush to the High Atlas, and they wind up on the Esplanade of the Dome of the Rock.
Mm.
What explains Afghanistan, Iran, Sudan? The Islamic trend goes far deeper and broader than the Arab-Israeli conflict. It may be that the Arab-Israeli conflict is a cause for some of the sympathy that an Osama bin Laden might muster, but not for the terrorism itself, and not for these Islamic movements, which are so widespread and broad-based.
Martin Kramer, Anthony Lewis, we're not going to solve this debate tonight. I hope it hasn't been too tendentious, but we made a stab at it, and it's illuminating to see how the folks in the Ivory Tower look out on this world that we all live in. Martin Kramer is author of Ivory Towers on Sand, The Failure of Middle Eastern Studies in America, and a visiting professor at Brandeis University. Thanks very much for joining us this evening, Martin Kramer.
Thank you.
And Anthony Lewis. He of the longtime New York Times column and this evening among us, and we're very grateful for it. Thanks so much for being with us, Anthony Lewis.
Thanks to you.
Listeners, for ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Violence and anarchy have been rising for months in Africa's most populous nation, Nigeria. 3 years after emerging from more than a decade under military dictatorship, the country's fledgling democracy is threatened by the mounting crisis there. The country's largest city has seen ethnic riots, a police strike, and the death of more than 1,000 civilians after an explosion at an ammunition storage facility. Waziri Adio is a Nigerian journalist currently studying at Harvard. In this radio diary, he reflects upon recent events in his home country and how they have shaken the people living in Nigeria and at least one Nigerian living abroad.
The latest news issuing from Nigeria has been far from cheery. First came the bomb explosions of January 27th that flattened out a major section of Lagos, the country's commercial capital, and left more than 1,000 people dead. And on February 3rd, Lagos exploded into an orgy of ethnic violence that has brought another cycle of death and destruction. As a Nigerian living outside the country, I'm constantly alternating between anxiety and panic. I dash for the phone and the internet to make sure that my family and friends are safe. But even when my folks are safe, I'm bothered that they may not be for long. I'm concerned about the implications of all this for my country. I'm tortured by visions of a Rwanda on one hand and a Somalia on the other. I hope these dark visions won't become self-fulfilling prophecies. These developments create fears about the survival of the country's nascent democracy and the unraveling of Africa's most populous country. These are genuine fears. This West African country of 120 million people has been lunging from one crisis to the other since it embraced democracy almost 3 years ago. Soldiers have ruled Nigeria for 28 years. Though discredited by its record of incompetence, human rights abuse, and corruption, the military is still a factor of Nigerian life and may yet strike again. The bomb explosions reminded many Nigerians of their fear of another military coup. As the explosives in the ammunition dump combusted one after the other, the whole city of 12 million people quaked. Rockets, bombs, and shells thundered. Houses shook, and flames and smoke swirled the air. People ran for cover to escape the explosions and a possible military coup. Hundreds of them were trapped in a fetid canal overgrown with weeds. Many of those who ran into it underestimated its depth. President Olusegun Obasanjo showed up at the site of the tragedy very early the following day. But when heckled by the angry and disillusioned crowd, he snapped. "Shut up, I don't even have to be here," he said, and stormed out of the place. Though the president has tried to explain his unreflective reaction and has set up a disaster relief fund, his behavior represents the arrogance and insensitivity of Nigerian leaders. Such attitudes lead people to think there is hardly any difference between military and civilian leaders, and as such undermine a broad-based support for democracy. But it is this regular outburst of violence that really put democracy in jeopardy. Since the civilian government took over on May 29, 1999, Nigeria has been a theater of low-intensity and sometimes virulent ethnic and religious violence. More than 10,000 people have been killed so far. Nigerians have a lot to do to manage their diversity, deepen their democracy, and make their country work. But this important African country also needs Americans and other Western countries to assist with infrastructure development, capacity building, and electoral monitoring. This is a token price to pay for building a sustainable democracy and avoiding a monumental breakdown. With such assistance, people like me will have to live in constant fear of another violence and destruction, won't be constantly tortured by the possibility of living under another military despot in my country, and won't be relieved of the fear of Nigeria becoming another Sierra Leone or Rwanda or Somalia.
Waziri Adio lives currently in Boston, Massachusetts. Listeners, we want to hear your stories on our show. Radio diaries begin with an email or a letter from you. They start as an essay of up to 800 words. We want to hear about how your lives intersect with what happens in the news. You can email us at onpoint@wbur.org. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Kim Bishari, Darren Manoogian, Tim Monroe, and Laura Tancuso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're